Welcome to Turning Point, a podcast dedicated to sharing the always inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking stories of people working in the social services profession. We'll be hearing stories of triumph over incredible odds, as well as the setbacks and challenges that people face along the way. We'll hear from people working in addiction and mental health, residential treatment programs, and community-based services, as well as some of the clients that those people serve. We'll be focusing on how to increase your impact as a professional and the role of helping people overcome their own challenges through stories of impactful moments, both in treatment and in life. We'll hear tips, tools, strategies, and resources that you can apply to your own practice starting today. Turning Point is brought to you by Enviros, a diverse social services organization dedicated to strengthening youth and families in Alberta through a unique and powerful combination of experiential, strengths-focused, family-centered programming. You can learn more at www.enviros.org. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Coulard. Welcome to this week's episode of Turning Point. This episode is with Clara Hughes, and of course you know Clara Hughes. She's Canada's sweetheart. She's the only athlete to ever multiple medal in both Summer and Winter Olympics. And while most professional athletes devote their entire lives to training, Clara spent her teenage years using drugs and drinking to escape the stifling home life her alcoholic father had created in Winnipeg. She was headed nowhere fast when at 16 she watched transfixed in her living room as gold medal speed skater Gaétan Boucher effortlessly raced in the 1988 Calgary Olympics. Dreaming of one day competing herself, Clara channeled that anger and frustration and raw ambition into the endurance sports of speed skating and cycling, and by 2010 she'd become a six-time Olympic champion. But after more than a decade in the grueling world of professional sports that stripped away her confidence and bruised her body, Clara began to realize that her physical extremes, her emotional setbacks, and her partying habits were masking a severe depression. After winning bronze in the last speed skating race of her life career, she decided to retire, determined to repair herself. She's emerged as one of the most committed humanitarians, advocating for a variety of social causes, both in Canada and around the world. In 2010, she became national spokesperson for Bell Canada's Let's Talk campaign in support of mental health awareness, using her Olympic standing to share the positive message of the power of forgiveness. I was absolutely thrilled to spend, you know, a few moments, a half an hour or 40 minutes, chatting with Clara about her journey, and really excited that she's started to experience the Enviros family. She's coming out to base camp soon, and she's going to be our keynote speaker at our October 28th gala event, which is a celebration of 40 years of providing services to the youth and families of Alberta. So really excited that that Clara took a few moments to chat with me, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did.
So maybe you can give us a little bit of background on turning points in your life, you know, starting with, you know, you're 16 years old and by happenstance or watching TV and you catch some speed skating at the Calgary Olympics, and that obviously changes the trajectory of your life. Are there other moments in time that you can kind of think back and say, this is a really definitive turning point in my journeys thus far?
Oh, there's so many turning points in my life. It's a very long and windy road, but I look back at the impact that individuals have had on my life, and you know, in a positive way, and really, really helping me along the way. But I had many great coaches who really showed me what was possible and inspired me to be better and to really stay connected to what I do. The turning point of meeting my husband 20 years ago. Meeting Peter Guzman in Oregon and really his impact of who he is and his values and how he tries to live his life and the connections that he makes in the natural world, in turn connecting back with himself, is something that really changed me and impacted me, because, you know, being a city kid growing up in Winnipeg, I didn't really have that strong connection to nature until I met Peter, and it's really changed my life. 20 years later, I'm still seeking out those opportunities to connect with the natural world and really make that strong connection back with myself. And it's been so tremendous in my healing path, that understanding of the importance of connecting with nature. You know, when I also think of the different counselors and therapists I've worked with over the years and along the way and continue to work with, and the impact that they've had on me and helped me, you know, shift the direction that maybe I was going in at a certain time that could be in a destructive way and in a hurtful way, helping me understand why I am feeling and acting the way I am, and also empowering me with the confidence and belief and the tools to shift that direction that I may be going in the psychological sense. So there's so many.
Yeah. No, I mean, all of our lives are just one turning point after the other, I suppose. Is there anything?
Well, it should be. I hope it is. I mean, that's the adventure, right? And that, I also think I recently was at the Banff Center just last week, and my husband Peter and I heard Pico Iyer give a speech, or actually it was a conversation, and it was so interesting. One of the things he said, you know, you can get caught up in achieving things and really chasing after these goals and these awards and these successes in whatever realm you are in life. You get caught up in becoming something and raising your status. And he said, actually, if you live that way with those ideals and those values of I have to achieve this to become something, he said it's actually a really linear way of being. And he said it becomes very boring and routine, and life goes by really fast if you don't allow for things and shifts in your own direction to come in and totally change your past, and you end up going places you never dreamed possible and really being connected and feeling so alive. So it was interesting to hear that from a great writer, a great travel writer who wrote a beautiful book called The Art of Stillness that had a profound impact on me about connecting and disconnecting from these gadgets that we have in our hands all the time. And just the thought of, wow, you know, the moment you think you're there and okay, I'm here and I've got this thing going and it's all good and I'm succeeding, it's the moment you kind of need to think, okay, where else can I go?
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive sometimes, I think, because, you know, we set goals and just the act of doing that kind of tells us that we're not enough and that the current moment and the present moment isn't enough. We're always striving for that next thing.
And also striving for something that's going to define you instead of looking within for the definition of self. And I definitely fell in that path of destruction. And I call it also addiction as a young athlete, because I was addicted to winning, to trying to define who I was, to feel I was worth something, and try to fit, you know, really numb a lot of this guilt I had inside, coming from a very dysfunctional family that, you know, was riddled with addiction issues with my father, and just really not being able to make any sense of that, except really feeling inside subconsciously that it was my fault, and trying to cover that up and become something by winning things in sport. And it ultimately led me to an implosion and a breakdown, because nothing outside of me was going to fix that confusion inside. Nothing was going to heal what was going on inside. It's taken many years to be on a healing path that I'll quite frankly be on for the rest of my life. And I'm okay with that, but I fell into that trap of thinking success was going to define me and make me worthwhile as a human being. And everybody outside me thought I was great. But inside I was really, really struggling with Olympic medals hung around my neck. I was struggling.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting for listeners to hear, and just for the general population to, and maybe getting some of your perspective or your experience on going from that kind of idealized Olympic medalist to someone who is human and struggles. Was there any kind of internal battle? I assume there was a big internal battle of kind of when to share and how much to share. Because a lot of people struggle with depression and mental health and addiction, and don't end up writing books about it and being advocates, even though they have lots of status and power and they could make a big impact. What shifted for you, or what was the impetus behind you saying, you know, this is a piece of my journey, I'm going to own it, and I'm going to make it known, and I'm going to use it for, you know, the betterment of society or helping other people? What happened there?
You know, it really didn't occur to me even that you could share something like this until 2010, and it was after the Vancouver Olympics, and, you know, I had won my sixth Olympic medal there, and I had long been on a healing path with a lot of support and had, you know, really established a sense of who I was, and I was okay with not winning. I didn't need to win to be something. And after those Olympics, I did win that medal, and the Vancouver Games, in many ways, you know, was a really huge connecting time of Canadians from coast to coast to coast, and it was a sporting event that brought us all together, and people recognized me, and I'd be in airports and on streets and people would say, I recognize you by your smile as soon as you smiled. And at that time, you know, my dad was really struggling with alcoholism and unbeknownst to me, the beginnings of dementia. and my sister was struggling with drug addiction. And my sister has had one heck of a struggle in life. She's, you know, as strong as me and has a massive capacity, and she's a survivor with a capital S, but her life's been very difficult. She didn't become an Olympic athlete and find a way out or have that opportunity open up to her, or for whatever reason, her life path went differently. So, you know, as much as people would tell me, oh, as soon as you smile, you know, I'm so proud of you, I just started realizing that there's so much more to me than people know. And I also realized that I had an opportunity to share when I found out from one of my sponsors, Bell Canada, that they were going to take mental illness on in a big way and tackle the stigma attached to mental illness and addiction. And they were going to change their charitable giving and put it 100% into mental health awareness. And not only that, you know, here in Toronto, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH, they said, we're going to sponsor CAMH, but we're also going to put our name on the side of the building. And nobody's done that before. It's always kind of these anonymous or silent donations. Because, well, nobody really wants to talk about mental illness, right? Yeah. And so they said, we're going to do this differently. And I found out about this after the games, and I asked to be a part of the campaign just in some way because, you know, it's a part of me, and I explained why. I explained my family situation, my personal experience, and I just said, I think I have something to share. And in whatever capacity, I didn't know I'd end up being a spokesperson for this. That didn't really occur to me. I just thought, I don't know, there's something here that I just instinctively and intuitively felt I could contribute to in a positive way. I didn't know how it would be received. I didn't even have any fear of being accepted. I just thought, I have to share and disclose this because so many people think I'm something that I'm not. They think I am just this bundle of joy and happiness and strength and success, and there's so much more. And I just felt like I have this chance to let people know I'm human and let them know that I'm vulnerable and I fail more often than I succeed and I struggle more often than I soar. And I just thought maybe someone will connect to it. And so it really, it wasn't something that I thought about, but I also have to say that it's not for everyone. And there are a lot of days when I wonder, like, is this even, can I do this? Because it's so huge. And when you share and when you connect through struggle, you become a listener and you become a source of sharing. And I've learned through this campaign the value and the importance of listening. And there's so often that sometimes I go back to being that kid who feels like, she failed because I didn't fix my messed up family, that I feel I'm failing people because I can't change it or fix it or help them. But I'm always reminded that it's important to listen. And Peter, my husband, reminds me of that a lot. He said, he always says, like, Claire, you listen to people and you let their voice be heard. And that means something and that matters. And so I always try to remember that and encourage people not to, you know, stand on a mountaintop and yell out and like let their voice be heard of every struggle they've had or what they're going through. That's not for everyone. For some people, it takes so much to just go to your doctor or go to a counselor or go even talk to a friend and say, hey, I think there's something wrong here and I don't know what to do. I need help. So honestly, like that takes as much or more courage to do what I've done. What I've done, I've been able to do because I have a platform that I'm coming off of, and it's a very successful one in the highest level in winter and summer sport. So it is very, very, very different for me to stand there because people accept me because I'm this package of, yeah, but she succeeded. That's not the reality for many people who struggle. And I'm very aware that my experience of acceptance and advocacy is not a universal one. And until we get to the point of being able to listen and accept and applaud and value and revere the person that doesn't have the Olympic medals, that doesn't have the success, that doesn't have the status or platform, until we get to that point, I will say we have a long way to go.
Yeah, I think we certainly do. And I think, I mean, that's the stigma that's still out there that you're working
exactly.
so diligently to overcome, just to get people
exactly.
to realize that it's not a deficiency to ask for help and to admit weakness and to illness.
Or it's not even, I don't even see it as admitting weakness. I see it as acknowledging a health issue, acknowledging a sickness, an illness, acknowledging it, and then the problem becomes, you know, it's not just, okay, the person was able to ask for help or say there's something wrong or say, can you help, you know, what, help me with this. The system doesn't support those that are ill. Our provincial and federal healthcare system doesn't support it. There needs to be massive shifts in that because people are coming out. People are, you know, asking for help. People are revealing illnesses. And then the system is saying, okay, here's some, you know, medication, go home, you'll be fine. When it doesn't work that way, healing and healthcare, mental health care is something that's a puzzle, and it's a different puzzle for each person. For one person, that's medication and counseling and peer support. Another person, you know, it's exercise, nutrition, medication, counseling. Another person, it's a psychiatrist. Another person, it's a psychologist. Another person, it's mindfulness training. It's something that's very different for each person, and it's something that takes many, many different influences to allow for proper treatment and ultimate healing and ultimate return to society, to family, to community, to work, whatever the person's role is in their life, returning and functioning, you know? So there's so far to go. And as hopeful as I am, is as pissed off as I am because it's not happening fast enough.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's a battle I definitely continue to fight and wage. But it's also something that I get really frustrated with because there, quite frankly, are too many lives that are lost to these illnesses. And it should not be accepted by our society, a very rich society in the developed world. It should not be accepted that there is not proper access to care. And that it's seen, in many ways, I almost feel like it's seen as a privilege, not as a right, and it should be a right.
Absolutely. What would you change if you had a magic wand and you could change one thing tomorrow about the system or about anything related to people healing? What would that be?
The first thing I would change would be the healthcare dollars that are given to mental health. And it's just the percentage is far too low considering how much of visits to emergency rooms, to doctors, to hospitals are mental health related. You know, I think in Ontario, it's something like 6%. When it was institutionalized care, it was something like 13 to 14%.
Wow.
And then when they went to more, you know, community-based care, it's gone down and down and down because they're no longer paying for these big hospitals. That should never have shifted because you're making people even more vulnerable because you're saying, okay, we're going to approach this differently, but we're going to cut all the funding. So for the most part, you know, what's available are psychiatrists. And there are a lot of people that don't need that level of care. And if you're in that in between, like I am, I don't need a psychiatrist. A psychologist is more than enough for me. I pay for that out of my pocket. It's $225 an hour. How many people can afford that? You know, I'm an independent contractor. People that have benefits from work may be in a different situation, but you know, it's not that the funding, it's nowhere near adequate. So the first thing I would change would be percentage of healthcare dollars. The second thing I would change would be what is funded. The middle range of treatment of programs need to be funded for people, need to be available for people. Peer support needs to be funded. Cognitive behavioral therapy needs to be funded. Mindfulness training needs to be funded. Psychologists need to be funded. It needs to not be seen as this like fringe area that's fundraised to allow for access. It needs to be seen as part of the healthcare system. And And also, you know, all the frontline healthcare workers, I would absolutely have every single one of them trained, including all doctors would have training in basic psychology. And like mental health first aid, every single one of them would know how to react and respond when they see someone in a crisis situation related to mental health. So that's a whole list of things.
Then,
you know, but the top of my list is always just access, because that's the biggest thing I hear from people is there's nothing there.
Yeah.
I have looked. I was turned away. I was sent home. My child was sent home. I stayed at the emergency. I would not leave with my child in that state of sickness. And I hear this over and over again. I lost my son. I lost my daughter. I personally have lost friends to suicide. I've also lost a friend to stage 4 cancer. And my friend that died of cancer, she died because it was found when it was at stage 4. My dear friend who completed suicide last year, she was at stage 4 when she started getting help. And how many people can recover from that? If you compare cancer to mental illness, no, you know, it's not right. So, there's so much I would change. And I would also change our attitude towards this. I would change how people think about this, about addiction and mental illness. I would change the education we have. I would change the way movies portray the mentally ill. I would change the way society receives those who are sick. So that's a whole list.
You've got a lot of work ahead of you. That's great. I'd like to dive in a little bit into kind of your experience with nature and wilderness as a bit of a healing modality or as a piece of your journey. And do you have anything that stands out, any of your experiences? You do a lot of endurance events. I noticed the Appalachian Trail and some big bike rides and those kinds of things. Is there and one in particular that stands out as a turning point for you or as a particularly poignant moment in the wilderness that you'd like to share?
Oh, so many. Really, you know, when I hiked the Appalachian Trail, it took 139 days, 3,500 kilometers. And the best part for me was the last day when, you know, you go, I was northbound. So the finish is in on a mountain called Mount Katahdin in Maine in the Baxter State Wilderness and State Park, sorry. And everyone was talking about, oh, Katahdin, when you get up there, you're closer. It's the place and you're going to feel so alive. And it was this mythical place. And all through hikers on the Appalachian Trail, you have gone through every human emotion, every physical pain you can have, and you're exhausted. And for me, when I arrived, I felt like I don't even need to go up that mountain because this has been such a complete experience. Every single day, the way in which I walked, the way in which I camped, the way in which I allowed myself to be completely present and just not trying to go faster, not trying to go further. When I felt very tired, I took a day off. It wasn't a race. When I walked and I felt the connection with the forest and the animals, where I literally got to the point where I felt like the squirrels were my brothers and sisters and I would greet them as such. And I'd see a tree and I would see this living being and I would touch it. Especially the old trees, and I would feel their wisdom, and I would just talk to that tree. I really felt like not only was I completely connected with nature, I was completely connected with myself. I didn't tell people on that trail that I was an Olympic athlete or anything about myself. My trail name was Red Feather, and the people I met on the trail only knew me as Red Feather, and I could just be who I was in that moment, who I presented myself to be, and it was liberating. And when I reached the end, I was so satisfied with the journey that I was really felt like I almost don't even want to go up that mountain because I so don't even want this finish to define what I've just done. And I did go up and it was great. And I arrived, you know, I walked up as the sun was rising and I reached the summit and I was up there at the end of the Appalachian Trail, 2,189 miles later, and there was a young couple there, and I chatted with them, and after we'd been talking for about 10 minutes, they said, so where did you hike from? And I said, well, actually, I guess I hiked from Springer Mountain in Georgia. And that's when they said, you hiked the whole Appalachian Trail? And I said, yeah, I guess I did. And it just didn't matter. So that, for me, I still can't believe I got to experience that. And had this hike only been a week into that hike, I was in that same mindset. So it really did a lot for me as a human being and allowed for a connection to myself that has helped me a lot in my life and helped me understand who I am and where I fit in and what's important.
Yeah, I think actually that should be mandatory for being human, is spending, you know, an extended period of time in the wilderness.
I think so.
I think there's nothing quite connects you to the grander world and to yourself than the time out in the woods. I spent a month on the Athabasca River a number of years ago.
Oh, nice.
And same kind of journey from Jasper all the way up to Fort Chipewyan up in the and just
excellent.
You know, same kind of paddle when you're feeling it and pull over and camp when you're not, and
yeah,
to just witness the splendor of the world. So that's that's great. Shifting gears just a little bit to your book, about a year ago you published Open Heart, Open Mind. What was that process like, writing down your story?
It was a bizarre one.
Yep.
And, you know, I had a lot of help. I worked with a fantastic writer, Sylvia Fraser, who, when we worked on the book together, she was 79 years old and a very wise woman who understands trauma and who has lived such a remarkable life and is such a survivor. So it was really fantastic working on the book with Sylvia. And in some ways, it was also kind of re-traumatizing looking back at a lot of things in my childhood, in my early years as an athlete. Sometimes you forget how messed up you were.
Mm-hmm.
Until you look back and start reading your own journals. And so it was bizarre in some ways. And in some ways, I honestly, if I could have bailed on the book late in the game, like the final edit, I probably would have, because at that point, I was just like, what am I doing? And what is this? And it was really, really hard. But I was in too deep, so I couldn't get out of it.
You were committed.
And yeah, but, you know, what I'm really proud of the book is that it's all going to charity. So I've donated all the money that I've made from the book. The advance, all the profits that I've received go to charities. And they're, you know, to Right to Play, Sport for Development, to Take a Hike, Adventure-Based Learning out on the West Coast, to local Canadian Mental Health Associations, to a lot of different organizations. So it's all like Sport for Development, youth-based and mental health related charities that the profits of the book have gone to. And I'm really proud of that, because I just realized, you know, early on that, I mean, actually from the very beginning of having an idea of doing a book, that I didn't want to be profiting off of this. I didn't want to be anywhere trying to sell my story or feel like there was some agenda that I had. And I feel really, really good of making that decision, and that, you know, the funding has gone to great places and continues to go to good places.
Yeah, well, that's great. I don't know if you know Margot Talbot. She's out in Canmore. She wrote a book. She's a nice climber, wrote a book about her journey through addiction. And she said that the only way she could write her story down was with the intention to not publish it, was kind of what got her through the writing process. And then finally came to the point where, oh shit, I actually have to publish this, and had a similar kind of, oh God, I'm about to release this into the world. What's going to happen?
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a process, and a scary one at that. So what's, aside from your charity work and your advocating for mental health, what else do you have on your plate? What else are you up to these days?
Oh, well, you know, I'm involved in a lot of different things, and it's been so fun and so just, I don't know what the word is. I feel very fortunate living in Canmore now. Living in Alberta again, you know, Peter and I lived in Alberta and Calgary for 10 years when I was a speed skater, but we really didn't know Alberta. And, you know, we're getting to know the mountains, we're getting to know our backyard, but we've made so many amazing friends down on the Blood Tribe, up in, over in Siksika First Nation, and then also, you know, with the Stoney Nakoda in, you know, the community of Morley. We went to the Chiniki Powwow in August, and we just really feel like, oh, wow, we had no idea how rich it is here. And all of our Indigenous friends that we've been so lucky to meet and to feel like they really let us feel like we're accepted. And we have felt such a strong connection to where we live because of those friendships. So, you know, those are things that we're always working on making richer, just really experiencing the place we live through the people, the first people of that land who have such a strong connection and the, all of their traditions and their culture that they've so generously shared with us, been able to go and do sweats down with our friends, the Eagle Bear family down near in Standoff in the Blood Tribe. I'm going to do a sweat this weekend in Morley, and it's all for me a big part of my healing path and my human experience as well. It's I just that we give a lot of our time goes to making friends and having shared experiences that really show us different ways of living and different perspectives. But also, you know, I'm on two different board of directors for the Rights Plays International Board of Directors. I was in the Palestinian territories last week. I was in Gaza and in the West Bank, participating and learning about the programs over there. And then yeah, I'm also on the Rita Hall Foundation Board of Directors with the Governor General. So I'm able to be involved in the programs with that foundation, particularly the Northern programs, the Indigenous programs. So it's been really cool. I'm an honorary witness for Truth and Reconciliation, which, you know, has allowed for connections again and experiences and just trying to really encourage and support particularly young Indigenous people to just fully know that their capacity is enormous and they can do anything. Give that encouragement, learn from the survivors of residential school, learn from the survivors of relocation and the aftermath of colonization, really understand that history and continually learn it and make sure that those around me are not speaking incorrectly and standing up for what I know is the true history and the amazing experiences I've been lucky to have with Indigenous people, really sharing those experiences because the media we're often fed is very one-sided and unfair. So I try to give my own experience, which is a very positive and real one. So all of those things I feel lucky to give my time and energy to and then also just getting out and moving, riding my bike, going for hikes, going for runs. And I make a little hashtag on Twitter and Instagram. It's called Movement is Medicine. And it's just something I started writing just to let people know that this is a part of my healing path. When I'm out there, I'm not training anymore. It's for my head and my heart.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Sounds like you have a very rich and diverse life right now, which is great.
Well, I try to make it that way, but, you know, at the same time, Jeff, it's sometimes it's good to shake things up and turn things upside down. And I think as no matter what you're pursuing, like I said, with what Pico Iyer said about, you know, spending a life pursuing things, achieving things, it can become very linear. So I'm kind of feeling the need to shake things up. So there may be some adventures in store in the springtime and summer and fall and winter.
Yeah. Well, you'll have an adventure at base camp on the 17th. That's for sure.
I know. So, and I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah.
Great. Okay. I won't take up too much of your time because I know you're super busy, but if there's one thing you could leave listeners with, an action step that they can take, either if they're a helping professional who are helping people with mental illness, or if there's someone who's, you know, struggling with mental illness right now, what's the one piece of advice or one action step that you would suggest those two different segments take? So professional working with people and people looking for help.
Oh, the professional working with people is take care of yourself, look after yourself. You are front line of you're on the front line for this, and nobody is superhuman. No matter who you are, you have to make sure that you have the supports in place, because you are witnessing trauma and you're witnessing pain and illness, and make sure you take care of yourself and know that you cannot be Superman or woman. Everybody needs support. Everybody needs a circle of strength. And for those who are trying to support somebody who is sick, who is struggling, just know that you can't be there. You can't be there as every single role, every piece of the puzzle for the person you love and care about or you see struggling. Know that the best thing you can do is educate yourself to know what is available, what is out there. Educate yourself to know what to do in certain situations, what to say, what not to say. That information is all out there. Educate yourself and empower yourself to do the best you can to help the person that you love. And know that the best thing that you can often do is listen. And as it was something we undervalue as humans. We always want to hear our own voices and we wait to be able to talk. But when you're listening, listen deeply and listen very intentionally. And don't listen waiting for your voice to be heard. Realize that you're allowing someone's voice to be heard, and it's an incredible gift you can give somebody. And for those who are struggling, just don't give up. Please don't give up. Please know that that you will get through. Please know that you can't do it alone. Please know that you're not judged. Please know that you're not looked down upon. Please know that you're sick.
Those are all excellent pieces of advice for everyone to follow, because I think at any given time we can be all of those things. We can be supporters. We can be struggling ourselves and looking after ourselves and asking for help. Excellent advice. Great. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. And
All right, Jeff.
I'll get this cut and up on the web, and I look forward to meeting
Excellent.
You on the 17th.
We'll
show you Basecamp, and then again on the 28th, I think you're speaking at our gala event. So it'll be the month of Enviros here, month of October.
Yeah, no, I'm really very, very much looking forward to it. And I'm really glad that we're able to do the Basecamp visit before the event, just so I can have a deeper understanding of the impact of what you're doing, what Enviros is doing, and bring in, you know, some good impactful storytelling that's going to hopefully inspire people to give more and to support more and to understand more.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Turning Point with Clara Hughes, and I hope you check out the Enviros Gala that's coming up in a couple of weeks. It promises to be an amazing night of celebrating 40 years of serving the most vulnerable kids and families in Alberta, and Clara is going to be our keynote speaker. And so if you want to see her in person and hear her message, as well as enjoying some great food and a great night, check it out at www.enviros.org/gala.